This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Thank you very much, Thaddeus. It's a huge pleasure to be back in this hive, one where I have gathered a lot of pollen in the past. It's the, you know, the most innovative and interesting and cooperative of rare book collections anywhere, and it's always a delight to be here, both for the wonderful treasures it holds and also for its wonderful staff. And it's a special pleasure to come under Thaddeus's auspices. He took a course with me and the most formidable polymath in Princeton, Thomas DaCosta Kaufman, a course chiefly distinguished by the fact that Kaufman and I had a rule that I would be the first one to talk about all the images. He would be the first one to talk about all the text, which was guaranteed to infuriate the other. So this group of quite formidable students sat there with, you know, two red-faced, furious pedants hurling Latin imprecations at each other, and it's a testimony to Thaddeus that he has survived and would actually invite me to come. How does a Yale man make fun of a Princeton man? Well, in many ways, but one of the most effective was chosen by Gary Trudeau years ago, when he had George Will, Princetonian, rely on a student from Walden University, Trip Tripler, who spends a summer internship as George Will's quote boy, perched on a high stool, finding for him, "Quick, quote boy, I need something on the banality of contemporary society. Right away, Dr. Will, thwip, 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 well, don't you just hate paperclips? I know I do, Andy Rooney." And you see, it goes on and on. And obviously, one of the ways that a Yale man flagellates a Princetonian is by showing that he's not a good bee, that the honey that he produces still bears unmistakably the flavor of the flowers from which he took his pollen, unchanged by any personal process of digestion. I know nothing about real apiculture, but a lot about the metaphors, which is what I'll be talking about today. And what fascinates me, and what this exhibit, The Revolt of the Bees, wonderfully illustrates, is the durable power of the set of images connected with bees and apiculture, and the practices of reading and excerpting and commonplacing and reusing that they represent, practices which still survive to the present. So this exhibit, which is absolutely wonderful, celebrates with great artfulness this set of incredibly labile and powerful images and associated practices. Bees are immensely labile and fertile in classical literature. Just think about Virgil's bees, the Carthaginians, who appear as busy bees building a city and as angry bees. And then the Latins who appear as angry bees. Bees are everywhere in Virgil, and they're doing all sorts of things. But of course, one of the central things that bees do in ancient literature is read, or teach you how you should read. Seneca, in a mutable image that resounded in classrooms for centuries, warned students that we should follow the example of the bees, who flit about and cull the flowers that are suitable for producing honey, and then arrange and assort in their cells all that they have brought in, a plea for the creative exploitation of multiple sources, which he grounded, of course, with a well-chosen quotation. "These bees, as our Virgil says, pack close the flowing honey and swell their cells with nectar sweet." And it was Seneca who first made clear that this process, when carried out correctly, meant not the reproduction, but the transformation, the mingling and the metamorphosis of the sources used. We should so blend these several flavors into one delicious compound that even though it betrays its origin, yet it nevertheless is quite a different thing from that from whence it came. A process nicely carried out by Macrobius a few centuries later, who tells his readers that he's worked exactly as Seneca recommends, but of course doesn't mention Seneca, so the reader can have the thrill of pleasure of recognizing the original source and seeing that it's been modestly transformed in use. Now, how did you read like a bee? Well, the answer is simple and, in the first instance, sadly prosaic. You made a notebook. But the notebook is itself as labile a creature as the bee and takes on many gloriously illegible forms in antiquity and in its Renaissance revival. The humanists of the 15th and 16th centuries read with awe of the elder Pliny, who dictated so many excerpts to his secretaries, which they took down on their tablets, that when rearranged, they filled 160 commentarii, or full volumes on rolls, volumes which the younger Pliny explained had an enormous monetary worth, though, of course, he would never have thought of selling them. More important, they realized that these practices had underpinned that great rag and bone shop of ancient erudition, the elder Pliny's Natural History, one of their favorite books, and gave them a way to think about using Pliny in the spirit in which he had actually used his forerunners. At their most ambitious, both ancient writers and Renaissance readers took the reading of a bee as a form of serious mental discipline, strenuous and systematic. Macrobius writes that the actual practice of arrangement, and here he really edgily tries to combine the mechanical and organic metaphors, which naturally somehow have to be fused when you make the bee a metaphor for the human and the bee's production of honey a metaphor for the reading of books. The actual practice of arranging, accompanied by a kind of mental fermentation, buzz, 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 which serves to season the whole, blends all the extracts in a notebook to make a single unique flavor. No wonder that Brutus had spent his last evening before the decisive battle of Pharsalus making notes on Polybius, or that Augustus took notes from histories of good and bad examples and sent them off to those who were in need of moral instruction. Taking notes was a pursuit for the great and the good and the learned. Most exciting of all, I think, for the humanists was the rediscovery of the full text of a writer who has only come back into his own, an ancient writer who has only come back into his own in the last few years, Aulus Gellius. Gellius, a quarrelsome, querulous, and rather funny polymath of the second century, turned the notebook into a literary genre. In his preface, he recorded how, whenever I took in hand any Greek or Latin book, I used to jot down whatever took my fancy of any and every kind without any different plan or order. And I would lay these notes away as an aid to my memory, like a kind of literary storehouse. What Gellius then did, however, differently from Pliny, who organized his work systematically, was to make his finished commentaries, as he called his Attic Nights, follow his notebooks in their random order, so that discussions of ancient clothing would follow corrections of a line in Virgil based on a clever forgery of a manuscript by Virgil himself, and that in turn would jostle descriptions of early Roman law or customs in eating. The end of the 1420s, when Nicholas of Cusa discovered a full text of the Attic Nights, he realized that the preface, which in the Middle Ages circulated at the end of the second half, actually belonged at the beginning of the whole work. And it was in that form that the corrected text, set out by Guarino of Verona, the great teacher in the Ferrarese court of the Este, went into circulation in the 1420s and 30s. And it was Gellius who offered the ideal that really went into circulation. It's the rediscovery of this text that marks the beginning of modern beehive production in the humanistic sort. Guarino told his star pupil, Leonello d'Este, bastard son and future Marquis of Ferrara, that whenever he read, he should have ready a notebook in which he could write down whatever he chose, and he should list the materials he had assembled. Then when he had written, when he had to review the passages that had struck him, you wouldn't have to leaf through some vast number of pages. The notebook will be at hand, and the metaphor gets even more complex here, like a diligent and attentive servant to provide everything that you need. And the servant is not wholly metaphorical, since Guarino goes on to say, and this is a problem to which I'll come back, of course you may find it too boring and time-consuming to make your own notebook, but don't worry, you can always find a clever young man who will be happy to do the notebook making for you. The ancient teachers, Guarino said, considered this practice so important that many of them, including the elder Pliny, reportedly never read a book without taking notes on its most interesting contents. So here you have the notebook, the literary beehive revived as a tool and as a literary form at one and the same time. Now, the first need that the literary beehive met was a new, practical, and heartfelt one. Renaissance humanists believed that they were bound to write and even to speak pure classical Latin. And those who failed in this task, those who made solecisms or false quantities, ran terrible risks, as Poggio Bracciolini found when Lorenzo Valla, in a dialogue, had the cook and stable boy of Guarino of Verona read one of Poggio's texts aloud and dissect its grammatical and syntactic errors, word by word. The modern humanists had to avoid this terrible fate. And one way to do so was to make into his own flesh and blood the texts of the ancients, to become a living library like Peter Kien, the protagonist of Canetti's terrifying novel Die Brandung. More than one literally achieved this goal. Excuse me. Justus Lipsius, that late 16th century master of the notebook, showed that he had done so when he publicly offered to recite the text of Tacitus from beginning to end with a dagger held at his throat, and to be thrust in if he made a single error. Only system, method, and hundreds of notes and extracts could possibly underpin a practice of this kind. But in the course of the 15th and 16th centuries, the literary honeycomb mutated and took on a richer and more elaborated set of functions. In the first place, ancient theorists of argument, above all Aristotle and Cicero, had laid out what they called the commonplaces of argument, the set of topics under which you could find the proper arguments with which to attack any given literary task. Rudolf Agricola, the influential Flemish educator and dialectician, wrote in his book on forming studies the first manual of how to create a honeycomb of forms of argument, a work in which you could file enthymemes and other partial and full forms of induction, a work which would teach you how to divide any topic up into its subheadings and to which you could come back for the proper forms of argument to use. Agricola was John the Baptist, though, to the true savior and creator of the notebook in its full form, Desiderius Erasmus. And it's Erasmus who, in a series of extraordinarily influential treatises on education, his Manual de Rationis Studii and his great and candidly titled textbook on copiousness in words and ideas, for there is nothing Erasmus was if not copious, transforms the notebook in ways that really bring together all of the themes I've already touched on. Erasmus, like Agricola, treated the notebook as a combination of heads of argument, copiousness of things. Copia rerum meant knowing the proper arguments to use when you were actually trying to write an oration, a praise of folly, for example. Copia verborum, copiousness in words, meant making a stylistic notebook of the sort that Guarino had taught his pupils to make, a systematic collection of Latin forms of speech, idioms, useful words, and useful quotations. But the step that Erasmus took was a new one. Erasmus formally argued that good quotations, sententiae as you called them in Latin, were in fact not decorations but constitutive parts of an argument, that they were commonplaces in and of themselves. To cite them was not just to adorn what you wrote, but to give it strength. So in Erasmus's thought and in his educational practice, the stylistic notebooks of the 15th century, the dialectical notebooks of Agricola in the late 15th and early 16th, come together in a single enterprise which offers you, if you learn how to make a notebook in the proper way, a complete set of instructions for making arguments or praising or blaming in a way that will be rigorous, cogent, and attractive at one and the same time. style and content really blend into one another here, as they would in the humanistic tradition, not just in the Latin world of 15th and 16th century Italy and Northern Europe, but any of you who ever met a German or Austrian who was educated before World War II will remember the way they used to quote Goethe. The quotation from Goethe, which was the most powerful argument you could make after you'd actually exhausted your arguments. It's not quite a lost art now, but it's getting close. But I knew many of these at the Warburg Institute in the 1970s when I was a student, and that was, I think, the end of a coherent period in the history of stylistic education, which begins with Erasmus and the humanists of the Renaissance. The Erasmian literary honeycomb was an epic enterprise to create. Anyone, says Erasmus, who wants to read through all types of authors for once in a lifetime, anyone who wishes to be considered learned must read all authors from beginning to end, should collect as many quotations as possible for himself. You should then devise a complex, all-inclusive set of headings and subheadings, and then arrange them in the order you want, and under them note every locus communis, every sententia, whatever you meet with in any author, and particularly in the better authors. Examples, jokes, marvels, proverbs, metaphors, parables. This method will have the result of fixing in your mind what you read, and it will accustom you to use the wealth of your reading. There are some people who keep many things, as it were, laid up for use, but when they come to speak or write, they're poverty-stricken and bare. In this way, you'll have a whole apparatus for speaking, ready pigeonholed whenever you have to speak, and you can draw on it immediately. So the hive is going to be huge, beautiful, and just filled with delectable honey that you can pull out and smear into your writing without any further preparation. These precepts were not dead letters. In English public schools, the boys had to present their commonplace books every week for inspection by the masters. There were, of course, those who failed to put everything they ever read into a dissected and put it into a commonplace book, but those who did recognized that they were at fault. The influential Strasbourg rhetorician Johannes Sturm mournfully told his students, "I didn't do this, and I'm sorry that I didn't do it. I wish my teachers had told me to do it. I could be more helpful to you if only I had taken better notes." And similarly, the great Huguenot philologist Isaac Casaubon regretted late in life that "I read many things in my own library which I didn't copy out into my notebooks," though he did have the books. So the commonplace book was prescribed, it was taught, and it was carried out over and over again. Thousands of them fill our libraries, American as well as European. Here's a wonderful late 16th century commonplace book from the Beinecke Library at Yale. It's the first heading here is authority and begins with that famous line from Cicero about how "I'd rather be wrong with Plato than be right with those guys over there." And then goes on to give you thousands of ways to develop that, to cite other authorities, and other ways of introducing good quotations. So before you make the quotation from your notebook, you find the formula for introducing quotations from your notebook. You begin to get a sense of the scale of this activity. So the form of reading that literary behood required was rather different from reading as we know it now. It required strenuous attentiveness. It demanded retirement from the hurly-burly. And it had to be carried out pen in hand, as in this famous illustration from Comenius's Janua Linguarum, where you see him teaching language by showing you things and showing you here the study and the student who reads and writes as he reads, marking his book and then taking extracts from it and putting them in his commonplace book. So this is period reading as we, on the whole, don't do it anymore. Ferociously attentive and very hard to distinguish from writing. And those of you who've read Montaigne's essays and other great treatises of its kind, or Burton's Anatomy of Melancholy, will know that there are forms of writing that are very difficult to distinguish from this kind of reading, and also that a great deal of artfulness can go into them. Now, the schemes that scholars used to carry out this work of retrieval were immensely varied. Everything from notes and little towers and pointing hands in the margins of their pages to extraordinarily ambitious schemes. My personal favorite is probably the one that a friend of Erasmus's saw in Venice, the work of the great Giulio Camillo. He built a wooden amphitheater large enough for two people to enter at one time, and marked with images of the seven planetary gods, the myths of the Olympians, and many other symbols, so that the whole interior of the theater was set out as a kind of allegorical encyclopedia. Now, it's common to talk about this as a memory theater, indeed as the memory theater, but in fact, under each sign was a drawer, and in the drawer were all the passages from Cicero about one given kind of topic. Camillo's theater was, in fact, not a memory theater in the precise sense of the term, but a magnificent retrieval mechanism designed to enable its owner to speak or write in perfect Ciceronian Latin on any possible topic as fluently as Cicero himself. Unfortunately, Erasmus's friend reported that Camillo stammered and spoke Latin with difficulty, excusing himself with the pretext that by writing so much, writing all of these excerpts, he'd actually lost this use of speech. So in the hands of someone like Camillo or William Harrison, the projector whose work has now been reconstructed wonderfully by Noel Malcolm and who designed a cabinet in which metal hooks could be systematically organized so that you could put little fiche on them in a systematic way, a system that you could move your excerpts around endlessly and sort them. The honeycomb bloomed as a kind of insane orchid, a sort of three-dimensional model of the brain itself. Now, the problems, and there were many problems with this enterprise, start with the notion of its naturalness, the notion that it's an organic process. For, of course, the organic process, the one of digestion and producing of something original, depended on one's doing all the work oneself. And Erasmus, good pedagogue that he was, and his followers who filled the grammar schools and gymnasium of Northern Europe, were much too skillful and experienced at teaching to expect anyone actually to carry out this extraordinary work of commonplacing, except in the very high elite of scholarship. At the very top, Guillaume Boudet, for example, that great French Hellenist, famous for on his wedding day, the house caught on fire, and his wife sent the servant to say, "Monsieur Boudet, the house is burning down." And he was, of course, in his study, and so he sent a message back saying, "My compliments to Madame Boudet, kindly inform her that domestic affairs are her concern," and went on studying. We have seven of Boudet's notebooks in Geneva, 2,000 pages, only a fragment of the enormous honeycomb that he must originally have created. At that very top, among the greatest scholars, the enterprise was inconceivably vast in scale. But for the humanist moyen sensuel, Erasmus and other pedagogues offered honeycombs mechanically reproduced. There was, for example, Erasmus's work on copiousness of words and ideas, which was not only an instruction manual, but also, in large part, a ready-made notebook, filled out, in this case, with 150 ways to say thank you for the letter in perfect Latin. Also with 250 ways to say, "As long as I live, I will never forget you." Kathy Eden, in a wonderful book, has shown the way that Erasmus, who created a society by letters of people who felt genuine love for one another, was building that practice and that idea into his textbook. Nonetheless, your basic student probably used it to find out how to say thank you for the letter, or indeed used other works like Henning Arniseus's late 16th century marrow of the traditions most used in oratory. My copy of De Copia. Thank you. Thank you. My copy of De Copia, he said, so excited by the prospect that he can't keep his microphone, actually is bound with this wonderful book. which is a notebook full of, in this case, ways of saying in perfect Latin, unaccustomed as I am to public speaking. Just what the schoolboy needs to begin an oration. You know, if only I'd had that when I had to write my bar mitzvah lecture. Now, and Erasmus's most popular single textbook, The Adages, a wonderful set of ultimately more than 3,000 essays, each taking off from a pithy saying, gave the intending young Latinist a magnificent toolbox with which to attack the difficult task of constructing a good piece of Latin. Anyone who read Erasmus knew that if your friend couldn't finish his dissertation, you could just tell him, manum de tabula, take your hand off the picture. Or that if your king wanted to invade another country for no obvious reason, you could say, dulce bellum in expertis, war is a lot of fun if you haven't tried it. And, you know, and any Latinist work written in Northern Europe in the 16th century just pullulates with these Erasmian sayings, used as if they had been excavated by the ingenuity and labor of the Latinist writing, but in fact derived at second hand. So there was the mechanization of the process. There was also the effect of the process. There's what happens to texts when you cut them up into little bite-sized morsels like breakfast cereal and put them into headings. And what happens is that each morsel takes on a life of its own, largely independent for the ordinary writer and reader, especially the reader who knows it only from Erasmus's notebook, of its original context. And these little bite-sized bits of erudition could be moved like counters, used arbitrarily, with less and less respect for their original meaning, their significance, or even the coherence of the argument that used them, or the philosopher who used them. It's another phenomenon that anyone who reads many Renaissance texts will know very well at first hand. Take Marsilio Ficino and his great work of medical astrology on drawing life down from the heavens. Ficino says that the sage, if he knows how, can warm eggs and procure life to them from the universe. And by doing that, he can create life. He can create bees from an ox. He can create a scorpion from basil. He can create a blackbird from sage. That the wise man is actually a kind of godlike priest who can give life to a creature. And then, accused of being a bad magician, he wrote and added to the same work an apology in which he said, well, of course there are bad kinds of magic that are done out of pure curiosity and that aren't serious. For example, there are those magicians who try to create life and produce birds, like blackbirds, out of sage. You see, the same example, which comes from the Picatrix, a medieval Latin manual of magic translated from Arabic and going back to much more recondite sources, serving absolutely opposite purposes in the same book. It's a little bit like a bar of soap used by the members of a football team in the shower. You know, it loses definition and it loses shape as each person applies it. So at this point, you begin to see, I think, why using and even making the literary honeycomb could be a source of shame as well as a source of pride. Why you didn't want to be caught using these expedients at least once you'd actually left the schoolhouse. And indeed, from the 15th century on, there are humanists, sometimes the very humanists who theorized the making of the literary honeycomb, who wonderfully satirize it. Angelo de Cembrio in his De Politeia Literaria, a set of dialogues about life at the court of Ferrara, which imitate the Attic Nights of Aulus Gellius, so they're mostly about humiliation. They're mostly about how to be a bad grammarian, brings on board an old schoolmaster who has excerpted all of Virgil and memorized him. And he challenges everyone he meets to quote him a line from Virgil, and he'll immediately cap it with the next line. Tito Vespasiano Strozzi, brilliant young poet, looks at him and says, Urbem quam dicunt Romam meliboea putavi, forcing the old man to say, stultus ego, and retire in humiliation, suffering, DeCembrio comments, the natural fate of those who spend too much time with the young. They become senile and insane, but also the appropriate fate for someone who relied too much on memory and too little on thought. Erasmus attacked more glamorous and significant prey in his magnificent 1528 satire, the Ciceronianus. Here he describes those scholars like Christophe de Longoy, Pietro Bembo, Jacopo Sadoleto, who really strove to write a perfect Ciceronian prose, so hard that one of them, Mario Nizzolio, wrote a lexicon of Ciceronian usage on the basis of the claim that if anything that could or should be said in Latin should be said in Ciceronian Latin. The Ciceronian in this dialogue explains that he's made three notebooks, an alphabetical list of every word in Cicero, so heavy that two men can't lift it, an alphabetical list of every phrase in Cicero, which is even longer than the first one, and a list of all the metrical feet that occur anywhere at the beginning or end of a sentence in Cicero. He documents Cicero's usage by compiling not just every word, but every appearance of it, and refuses to use a word in a form which did not appear somewhere in Cicero. And when he has to write, say, thank you for the letter, he waits till nighttime, retires into the study in the center of his house where no disturbance can take place, contents himself with a dinner of 10 currants and 3 coriander seeds, and there, behind his thick walls, double doors, and windows, all the cracks stopped with pitch and plaster, spends the whole night on a single perfect sentence. His antagonist makes fun of him in many ways. If I wanted to work on Cicero that way, he says, my wife would burst open the door, tear the books away from me, and burn them. And she'd find another lover, too. But his chief point is more elegant. The ancient painter Zeuxis, he points out, had to paint a Helen for the citizens of Croton. To make it a perfect and lifelike example of womanly charm, he didn't use a single model, but from all who offered themselves to him, he chose several who were more excellent from the rest, in order that he might select from each of them what was most comely. Now, Cicero told this story. Didn't that suggest that one who was seeking a single model of eloquence was failing to be a Ciceronian? No, replies the Ciceronian. If Zeuxis had found a virgin as beautiful as Cicero, he'd have stuck with a single model. And of course, the very statement that he makes condemns him wonderfully. It shows that for all his master of Cicero's words, he doesn't understand the content. He takes him only at his literal sense. And the passage also is a wonderful rewriting of Cicero's story. As you remember, it occurs in On Invention, and it's the beginning of a rather dry book of rhetorical treatise in which Cicero says, well, you know, Zeuxis had to paint this Helen, and so he says to the Cretonians, I need to see your 5 most beautiful women. And they say, okay. And then he says, naked. And they say, no, we can't do that, but we'll take you to the gym and you can look at their brothers. And you can conjecture from what the brothers are like what the 5 most beautiful women look like. And Zeuxis says, no, that won't work. And they pass a special law that enables him to have the 5 naked models. Erasmus, by eliding all of that in his rewriting of the story, both recalls Cicero's original joke, good homophobic Roman joke about Greeks, basically, to the erudite teacher and conceals it from the student, who will not be bothered. This is a favorite tactic in Erasmus, most wonderfully employed in his model exegesis. This is one of the great single uses of the honeycomb system. In De Ratione Studii, he gives you a model explanation of one line from a classical text. It is the worst line in the classical tradition from the standpoint of a Christian humanist. Corydon the shepherd was really hot for pretty Alexis. And Erasmus says, well, what you're going to tell them is this is about friendship. And you're going to tell them that friendship is a good thing. Friendship is between equals. It's not between one who's higher and one who's lower. It's between equals. There are many great examples of friendship. There's Achilles and Patroclus. There's Castor and Pollux. There's Narcissus and Narcissus. And he wonderfully compiles all this information. And at the end he says, and by the time you've laid down all this information, they'll have completely forgotten the original lines. And there's no need to worry that they'll actually be corrupted by it. So Erasmus himself, the great maker of notebooks, here suggests that the notebook, the honeycomb, can turn into a kind of prison in which its maker finds himself locked up, unable to see the world around him, unable to negotiate it, or to negotiate the distance between the ancient texts from which he compiles and the world in which he really lives. Now, commonplacing at the other end of the spectrum could be an extraordinary creative art. It could be actually a training in interesting ways to think about the ancients. And I'll just give you two examples. One from Justus Lipsius, whom I've already mentioned is a master of this art, and one from one from Jean Bodin, the great political theorist. Now, Lipsius is a great and sublime master of the notebook. In a letter on the study of history, he tells his pupil how to take four notebooks for the study of history, one on civil affairs, one on morality, one on politics. He very carefully separates morality from politics in the best Machiavellian way. And finally, one on antiquities. And of the one on antiquities, he says, this is where you put inscriptions, this is where you put information about ancient customs, rites, beliefs, and rituals. This, he says, is absolutely vital to reading. And it's an extraordinary sentence in its own right, because I would argue that it's the first place where we see, in this wonderful practice of honeycomb making, something like what Germans much later would call the hermeneutical circle. For Lipsius, you study history, you read your texts, you look at antiquities, you compile, and then what do they do? Why, they help you read the texts. So you go back to the texts, which of course you read with more penetration, and then of course you have to add to your notebook. And what do you do then? Why, you go back to your text. So in Lipsius's practice as a historical notebook maker, you really see a kind of historicism, he's really capable of theorizing and practicing an exegesis which will really be endless, the exegesis which we still practice, which will never arrive at a final reading of the text because there will always be something you can add to the equipment with which you approach it. But the triumph of notebook making for Lipsius was his Politica of 1589, a manual of politics in the form of a cento. The entire text is made up of quotations from ancient authors, historians, moralists, lawyers, systematically organized under headings to give you an instruction in how to be, in effect, a Machiavellian politicus, a modern, realistic master of politics. It's as clever as Ausonius's nuptial cento, in which the words of Virgil are turned to be a very witty epithalamium. It's incredibly popular. It goes through 15 editions in Latin between 1589 and 1599. Eventually, it went through 54 editions in Latin, plus translations into Dutch, French, English, Polish, Spanish, and Hungarian. And even the most hard-bitten professional politicians, like Bernardino de Mendoza, Spanish cavalryman, took time off between efforts to assassinate Queen Elizabeth to read Lipsius's Politica. And just listen to the way he makes his point. He's writing, remember, in Leiden, in the Netherlands, the new University of Leiden, a Calvinist university founded in 1575 with a forged charter from Philip II, who was still the legal overlord. And he says, what should you do about religious dissent? I say, he says, that those sin publicly who entertain wrong opinions about God and induce others to do so by making disturbances. Privately, those who entertain the same wrong opinions but keep them to themselves. Now, should those who do the first, who sin publicly, get off scot-free? No. Let them be punished by you, lest you be punished in their place. Cyprian, better that one perish than that unity perish. Augustine, the penalty for profanation of religions varies from place to place, but there always is one. Seneca, there's no room for clemency here. Burn, cut, so that a member perish rather than the whole body. Cicero. Challenged by Dirk Kornhert, a great Irenic and Erasmian figure, who said, how can you say burn and cut when you yourself have elsewhere admitted that you can't compel people to change their minds on questions of religion? Lipsius wonderfully replies, ah, you have to understand the way one makes a notebook. One needs to keep in mind the original context. Ure et seca, burn and cut. In Cicero's Latin, that doesn't mean burn and cut. It just means take serious measures. It means we have to take this seriously. And he says, this poor old guy, Kornherit, needs to go back to school. This is the whole problem. I would never have recommended anything like savage dealing with heretics. It's an extraordinarily skillful tightrope walk between the historical analysis and the modern application of these sententiae. And many emulated it in their commonplace books. This is from one of the commonplace books now at the Folger, William Drake, a 17th century English parliamentman, of whom we have more than 30 political commonplace books kept in Lipsius's spirit, which have been analyzed very well in a book by Kevin Sharp, and which show that this man saw commonplacing in the Lipsian spirit, pulling tags from histories and moralists, as the best tool he had to understand the Puritan challenge to the English monarchy, the English Commonwealth of the 1640s and 1650s. But I think no one reveals the splendors and the miseries of literary honeycomb making more vividly than Jean Bodin, the French jurist whose great mistitled masterpiece, that Greenland of hermeneutical texts, The Method for the Easy Comprehension of History, first appeared in 1566. It's a frightening book, and I say that technically. The great John Pocock, confronted with it as a young student at Cambridge, said, "We'll leave the vast semi-ruinous mass of Bodin's Methodists to one side," as he does in his great book, The Ancient Constitution and the Feudal Law, which was one of the first to show the radical originality of French legal and historical thought in the 16th century. For Bodin, history is universal. The only hope of resolving the civil and religious strife all around him in France and the Low Countries lay in finding, through precise and wide-ranging historical investigations, the exact constitution that would be most suitable to France, and reconfiguring the French state until it was perfectly shaped for the character of the French. This, in turn, required the most extraordinarily elaborate historical investigations. One must, for example, determine where each people originally came from, since climate and geography shaped what he called the ingenium or character of each people. To do that, one had to follow clues in language, as Bodin says, in words that sound like an adumbration of Marc Bloch, until you see the example he gives. We can tell, for example, from the name of the Walloons, who they are. The Latin name of Walloons is Uallones, and it shows that they were a French-speaking tribe who migrated north through the forests saying Uallonu, thus could be traced back to a southerly climate. The application is a little unlike Marc Bloch. Well, Bodin's central method for studying history is the notebook. He offers a vast bibliography of historical works, and he tells the person in search of information about his nation's character and the politics that would be best for it to make three notebooks, one for the history of the divine history of the church, one for the history of nature, since nature shapes culture, and one for human history. Then the reader must excerpt every history he reads, file his excerpts under systematic headings, and then, and here Bodin is most original, he must work through the extracts systematically and assess them using a code to explain the precise worth of each extract. For example, when he set down Themistocles' advice to burn the ships of Athens' allies in order to assert the power of Athens, which Aristides rejected, you should say, see, this is a CTU. It's a concilium turpe utile. It's a good plan, but it's really shameful. And there are also, there are also concilia which are utilia and concilia which are purely shameful. And you know, you get a wonderful system for filing the entire history of the universe in these three notebooks, all to be unified in the end by a careful pattern of checking constitution, climate, and character, and arriving at a solution proper to each people. Now, even in the 16th century, some contemporaries thought the system sounded clunky. Bartholomeus Keckermann, the great Danzig teacher, very influential writer, has a wonderful critique of Bodin in which he imagines him staggering around like Erasmus's Ciceronian with his three notebooks, each of them as big as the universe. More seriously, he points out that Bodin's argument left out a central step. History is not a discipline. History has no loci to offer. How then can you possibly make history the basis of your notebook, asked Keckermann. And here Keckermann has often showed how shrewd he was. For it's hard to describe a literary practice or an educational practice. If it weren't, we could remember what goes on in class. Think how hard it is to remember what you actually do or suffer in class every day. It's partly nature protects us from these memories. We couldn't bear them. But it's partly that it is very difficult to find the terms to describe a practice of reading, which is really a tacit practice. And if you look at the way Bodin actually read, you see that he actually did exactly what Keckermann recommended. His reading was very precisely constitutional, juridical, and legal. He took his headings from the Aristotelian Politics, which Keckermann would have agreed was a perfectly good basis for doing so. And you see this beautifully in the most famous passage in Bodin's Method. Early in the Method, Bodin explains that every state has a sovereign power. You can identify this sovereign power because it can do certain things that no other person or office in a state can do. It makes laws, it makes treaties, it has the right of appeal to it from all other magistracies. How has he arrived at this? He says, well, I compared the arguments of Aristotle, of Polybius, of Dionysius, those of the jurisconsults, and the entire history of states. So here, in the central passage in one of the most original works of 16th century political theory, you see Bodin describing the procedure he's actually employed, which is indeed to create a honeycomb with categories like appeal, power to make tax, power to make treaty. He's decanted his extracts into that, extracts of histories, extracts of theoretical treatises, and it's by that process of honeycomb making that he arrives at the conclusion, a doctrine of sovereignty which has no real counterpart in the earlier history of political thought, and which in his six books of the Republic he would develop into the foundation of 17th century absolutism. So in Bodin's case, you can see that the honeycomb could really be good to think with, as well as good to adorn with and good to compose with if you were feeling uninspired. But you can't assume that anyone made the kind of honeycomb he tells you he made. You actually have to look at his practice and see how it worked. Well, anyone discussing erudition has to wind up in Germany. It's the country of erudition. And I will finish up with one last process of honeycomb making, and it's one that really speaks in a way, I think, to this exhibition. The greatest impresario of commonplacing or honeycomb making of the entire 16th century was a South Slav, Matthias Flaccius Illyricus, a man who settled in the 1550s in Magdeburg and who, with the help of donors, organized a team of young men to write the history of the church, the first great systematic Protestant history of the church. Flaccius was unsatisfied with earlier efforts like those of Sebastian Franck, partly because they were doctrinally problematic, partly because they didn't seem to him to cover what you needed to cover in a history of the church. He had very comprehensive ambitions. He wanted a history of the church that told you how doctrines had changed, but also how liturgy had changed, how practice had changed, how poor relief had changed, and which explained century by century what the church had been like. How to do this? Well, you hire some people. You find some support to pay them. You gather material, and all over Europe, librarians feared the culter Flaccianus, the Flaccian razor with which he supposedly gathered his materials to take them back to Magdeburg. What did he have? Seven students, he says, endowed with reasonable learning and judgment on fixed grants. They carefully go through the readers, the authors assigned to them, and make excerpts from them, paying close attention to the goals established with great care in our preliminary method. They carry out a kind of anatomy of their authors and copy out everything under its commonplace heading, taking one century at a time. Now, here you see Flacius emphasizing the novelty of the method and comparing it to the public anatomy. Evidently, he had had a look at Vesalius's De Humani Corporis Fabrica and saw that as a kind of model of how the up-to-date young man would go about dissecting any structure, the text as well as the human body. But he was also a humanist, and so he says, "Next, we support two masters of arts, men of outstanding maturity, learning, and good judgment. They're given the materials that the hardworking little student bees have already collected from flowers in various places. Their job is to assess, outline, and arrange the materials that have already been assembled and work them up into a coherent historical narrative." So here, the honeycomb becomes not just a metaphor, but a kind of guide for one of Europe's first grant-supported collaborative historical research projects. It didn't meet with universal enthusiasm. In Wittenberg, where Melanchthon and his followers despised Flacius, they seized upon the new metaphor of the public anatomy. Flacius's anatomies of books, said one of his critics in a pamphlet, are all too well known, especially to the librarians whose books have experienced them. Worse still, the Wittenbergers turned on its head the ancient corporeal metaphor of the bees. In this case, the metaphor of the bees, with its emphasis on the organic and natural quality of reading and compilation, unleashed the scatological imaginations of Flacius's opponents. And scatological imagination was not in short supply among the great German thinkers of the 16th century. The seven inspectors, the seven students, they joked, were just the belly of Flacius's beast. They separated chyme from blood, and they sent their byproducts to the masters of the arts, and the masters of the arts were intestines. And what they produced, you can imagine from the metaphor. In this case, the whole notion of reading, compilation, and writing as organic is turned on its head, not as a process of creating something sweet, but very much as its opposite. Yet, Flacius's enterprise was an extraordinary one, very, very widely known, and when Francis Bacon came in his New Atlantis to describe Solomon's house, that great grant-supported structure of students of nature, he took from Flacius the idea of having paid permanent specialist employees, some to gather material, some to collect material, some to draw inferences from the material. In that way, though poor Flacius ended up covered with an unpleasant substance in his polemic, his model survived, even survived Europe's age of erudition to be the kind of model that the Royal Society of the 17th century looked back to. If I were Flacius, who liked mixing metaphors, that's another problem that the literary honeycomb can lead to, I would say that the literary honeycomb had a double edge. It could cut its user as well as the text. It is certainly clear that a Wittenberger could flagellate a Magdeburger for misusing the honeycomb as efficiently as a Yale man nowadays can flagellate a Princeton man. Nonetheless, I hope I've suggested that the commonplace book, that wonderful, crusted, varied, bizarre, labile literary tool, played many and vital roles in the practice of scholars' daily lives and literary work. It was a teaching aid for aspiring Latinists. It was a guide to formal argument. It was a hermeneutical tool. It was even a model and locus of research training that would continue to have an impact after the period in which books were seen as the source of all knowledge about life, the universe, and everything. Now, of course, the honeycomb is in decay. The signs of that are everywhere evident and wonderfully made manifest in this subtle and elegant exhibition. That fact, I think, is one of the most vivid markers we have of the distance that separates us from our literary ancestors in the Republic of Letters. Thank you. I forgot, this is the bibliography, this is the late 17th century bibliography of printed commonplace books, if you want a terrifying thing to look at. Sorry.
I also want to thank, too, Thaddeus and Aaron for all their great work and effort in putting this exhibit together and organizing this program, and for all the great things that the SWOT organization, the SWOT Foundation, has done for West Philadelphia and for the university. So you've heard about the bees, now time for the wasps. Does anyone want to stand first?
You mentioned in your talk a number of feats of memory that men can recite tasks. It reminds me of a Sanskrit proverb there. There's a Latin correlates that there are two types of things which cannot be regained: money elsewhere and knowledge in a book. And you also kind of undercut Francis Yates' memory theater. Actually a messenger of information and retrieval service. And so it seems to me that actually a lot of the function of a notebook is the result of the failure of memory.
I think that's absolutely right. And one of the things that I think supports that is that several humanists in the 15th and 16th centuries describe memory performers as clearly very striking and unusual, that is, as doing something that they themselves couldn't do. Marc-Antoine Mirbet, for example, is a very influential mid-16th century French humanist, has a chapter in his Varia Lectiones in which he describes someone he met who actually could hear a list of random words, just several people would dictate words while a scribe took them down, and he would then repeat the list and then could do it backwards, and he could do the same with lists of random numbers. But it's clear that for Mirbet, this is a form of performance by which a sort of street charlatan who was mildly literate earned money. It was not something that he thought he could or should be able to do. And my guess is that the normal humanist did depend on the written resources of his memory. That's not to say they didn't have extraordinary memories, but I think it is to say that the full memory system, I suspect, was employed relatively infrequently. And Yeats herself was rather skeptical about the extent to which memory systems would work for the memory purposes for which they were first intended. So there were certainly people who used them. There were certainly people who had extraordinary memories. I used to have one. I can still remember that I had it, but I don't remember anything that was in it. My teacher, Arnaldo Momignano, who was trained in a very traditional way early in this century, had such a memory. I once asked him...
But he had all the little slips.
Oh, he took little slips with carbon paper. He had a double slip system with carbon paper. But I once asked Momignano a question about a text which even you will agree is obscure, the Collatio Legum Romanarum et Mosaicarum, which is a late antique, very interesting late antique legal text that compares the laws of the Jewish polity with Roman law. And I said, do you know anything about humanists interested in this? And he said, yes. In 1928, the Linje published an article by Volterra, which has a footnote about that. I haven't read it since it appeared, but I think I'm right. And it was a long footnote, but by gosh, that footnote was there. So, anyone who's known classically trained people, and particularly people classically trained before the 60s, knows examples of extraordinary memory art. Hugh Lloyd-Jones, if you ask him a question about a Greek tragedian, he'll recite the passage and then recite the critical apparatus for the passage and tell you why the idiot who did the editing should have taken this up from the apparatus into the text. It is certainly part of the humanist tradition, but I think for most people, as with Boudet, who was a great, great scholar, it was founded on writing. You wrote and wrote and wrote, and it was the writing, the copying, the excerpting, the reshuffling that drove these texts into your mind so that you made them part of yourself.
But these people read their notes. I mean, read notes can be...
They're horrible to read, but I think they probably didn't. I think they wrote them to. I think the writing was a memory exercise.
Yeah.
And often because you couldn't go back. He must have had 20,000 pages of notes, and you couldn't go back through 20,000 pages. There's a very interesting Ferrarese scholar, Celio Cacognini, who has a letter on how to take notes, and he explains that he once tried to take notes on Pliny's Natural History, and it really was, you know, the map as big as the world. He had to give up because he found, you know, there was no way to do this except by reproducing the entire text. And I think mostly, you know, they were extraordinary in their memories, but it was writing that drove it home. Some of them had good handwriting. Joseph Scaliger, on whom I have concentrated, had beautiful handwriting. Momigliano used to say, a great man with good handwriting is twice a great man. I don't really think most of them were memory performers in that sort of metaphysical Yeatsian sense. Yeah, sure. And I have wondered if the Wittenberg guys actually had that in mind. But if they did, of course, they left it as an illusion that it takes detection. But, you know, there's nothing in the passage that indicates that, but it's entirely possible. Oh, it's... Yeah, he mines several people. It's this late 15th century generation of incredible erudites. They are, for Erasmus, practically classical authors themselves. Poliziano, Barbaro, Beroaldo in the incredible commentary on Apuleius. And Erasmus strip mines all of those texts. The thing is, none of them was well adapted to the needs of a student who needed to go in and have something and write a weekly composition. Erasmus's genius was in his ability to take, you know, the ancients, many of whom he had read, these moderns, and to distill from them this vast mass of material. You know, his classics were often texts that that until recently were not any longer familiar to most classicists. Sir Roger Miners once told me when he was translating Erasmus's letters, there kept being Greek allusions, which Allen didn't bother to identify because to Allen they were obvious in the edition, and that he had never read. And finally, he worked out that one of them was from Lucian. And in Miners' day, you didn't read Lucian. He was not considered classical. So he sat down and read Lucian and realized that Erasmus is just honeycombed. Then one of the things that he strip mined was the complete dialogues of Lucian. So, I think you're absolutely right. He was much more worried about practice than about classicism. I mean, for him, the question is always, how are we going to use this now and not, you know, is this genuine? This is most clearly in the case with the last verses of with the Comma Johannaeum in 1 John 5, where, you know, Erasmus says, you know, this wasn't in my Greek manuscript, you know, the three who keep witness in heaven, the three who keep witness, so I'm leaving it out. And he says, but, you know, if anybody, you know, find a manuscript with it, I'll put it in. So a manuscript was written in Greek, and the words were translated, and he was stuck. What was he going to do? It's in Dublin. And if you just open it, it falls open to that. So many people have consulted it. So, no, you're absolutely right. You know, even Poliziano, of course, sometimes fakes things and pillages slightly earlier writers. You know, this is the history of scholarship. You know, it always has this malevolence to it.
Where do you see the moment when it really begins?
becomes completely beyond the pale to do with what the humanists and the Renaissance scholars thought was natural. You took us through Mate Vlasic and I think of Dr. Franjo Tuđman and his method of writing books, which was to hire young scholars to shuffle around note cards and to put them into any order in which his publishing house would be forced to publish them. And Marxist scholarship at a certain level is full of books which have been written in this method by collectives.
Walter Ulbricht's History of the German Worker Movement, for example. I don't think he really had time to write that 9-volume history, though it certainly appeared under his name. So I expect that, like Leonel Adeste, he had earnest young men who did the work. I think this is a genuine problem. There is a very learned work, which I will not publicly cite, which was produced by a very famous professor at my university in Chicago in my time. This professor had a chair which gave him 2 tied research assistants, one who were friends of mine, one of whom made extracts from the sources. The professor didn't read the sources, he read the extracts. He then wrote this immense book in longhand and the other typed it up. And he kept doing this for 15 or 20 years. The resulting book was very long, was very seriously reviewed, is still published by a major press, it's in every library. And I remember a review in the English Historical Review, those wonderful put-downs of Americans. This is the best kind of American scholarship, where a professor and his students work together to create this great learned compilation. Now, I've often reflected on how you would actually judge this process. And he certainly thanked and paid for the people who did the work, yet no one would have known from reading the book that it was based on extracts done by hired labor in exactly the way of Flaccius Illyricus. It's, I think we're very ambivalent about these practices. Collaboration is very easily concealed and very often concealed. Cesare Baronio wrote the first great Catholic church history in response to the Magdeburg centuries, writes as if he's the sole author, when in fact it's a highly collaborative work in which there were, I think, 12 active collaborators involved, and they were quite indignant about this. One of my students is writing his senior thesis on the Hertz Pentateuch, and some of you will know that this was the first English language edition of the Pentateuch with Hebrew text, English translation, and English commentary replying to German and other modern scholarship that took an analytical approach to the Bible. It was done by the British chief rabbi, Hertz, who was actually trained at the Jewish Theological Seminary in New York. My student went to the archive in Southampton and discovered that the people whom Hertz sort of thanked briefly at the beginning had actually drafted most of the commentary. And this is in the 1920s. And one of them wrote and said, I really think I should get credit as an author here. And another wrote and thanked him, for the little bit of money he'd sent him. So I think we don't really have good definitions of authorship, collaboration, originality. In the world of scholarship, I sit on my university's committee, which assesses all appointments, promotions, and raises, since salaries only go up, though not much. And it's very interesting when you get, work by economists. Every economist has a writing partner, and every young economist's work is collaborative, and the writing partner is normally at another university. Now, economists have the highest salaries, and yet we are rewarding them for work which is explicitly shared with someone else, and where we have no way of knowing who had the brilliant idea that made the article worthy of acceptance in a major journal. Lab scientists take this to the extremes. You try reading the CV of somebody who's been a graduate student, a postdoc, and is now an assistant professor, and whose name has moved from the end to the beginning over time. And this is right now. We have no idea what we mean by authorship in our own realm of science and scholarship, much less anywhere else. So I think that these ideas are much more confused than we tend to treat them. I hope someday to write a book on the history of collaborative authorship from antiquity to the present, because there's a long non-romantic history of authorship as something which is collaborative. which you can see in the Roman custom of the public reading and rewriting of a book in the light of reactions to it. Or you can see in the humanist habit, one way you avoided making solecisms was to give your work to someone else who would often rewrite it. There was a kind of Maxwell Perkins in 15th century Italy, Niccolo Niccoli. And you know, if he hated everything his contemporaries wrote in Latin, saying, you know, that stuff's only good in the latrine, take it out there. But if you could persuade him, he would go through your book and rewrite it for you in a good way. The first proofreaders do this in the 15th and 16th centuries. And you know, I'm now supervising two brilliant young men who are editing the correspondence of Joseph Scaliger, for which I will not take credit, though I did find the money for the project. And I will take credit for that. And the two of them have found that his 17th century student edited his letters for the press to prevent his teacher from being seen making mistakes in Latin grammar and sequence of tenses and moods. So these letters are thoroughly edited in the course of writing, and we are agreed that Scaliger would have wanted the work to appear as corrected. He didn't write his letters in the expectation that a modern would say, well, you have to publish the holograph. He would have been shocked at that idea. He would have wanted the collaborative help of someone to look it over and fix it up. Well, it is, but that's the problem. You know, if you become perfect at it, you're in the position of writing Don Quixote again without having Borges to explain that it's okay. The writing is this tightrope walk in which you're attempting to reuse, reconfigure, to put a twist on things, which is just enough of a twist to be recognizable as a twist, not so much to be a mistake, unless, of course, it's obviously a deliberate mistake of the sort that you make in order to charm your readers. One thing I didn't go into, but should have, is the rules for misquotation, since, of course, in classical rhetoric, you're not supposed to quote perfectly accurately all the time, and there are, you know, formal ways in which you are meant to reshuffle the things that you quote to show that you're doing it from memory and not from a notebook. Norton has a wonderful discussion of this in the Antike Kunstprosa. And there are formal rules for this. And this is, by the way, a great problem if you study, for example, the pre-Socratics or other writers whose work survives in fragments quoted by later writers. There's often a tendency in modern scholarship to assume that these quotations are very precise, but it's not always the case that the people making these quotations would have wanted to be precise. They may well be changing things. So I agree. I think, you know, to make ourselves think our way into the writing habits of the pre-modern learned is an incredibly demanding exercise, and involves the same kind of strenuous attentiveness that they brought to the task of reading. We, of course, have Perseus and other ways of faking our knowledge of what they're alluding to. And that way we can pretend to recognize more things than we really recognize the first time through. But I do think that you have to cultivate a way of reading these texts, and in the end, I guess this sounds like Guarino, you kind of have to build it yourself. You have to sort of create your own imaginary notebook of things to look for and things to notice, and then you can begin to think how you were in the period meant to read this book, how you meant to unpick this tapestry. But reading in translation, for example, doesn't do it for you.
One final question.
I was interested in the little image you showed, the student reading and copying out, but in the image there are also letters, and they refer to the object in this room. And this system in itself, of course, the Jesuit teaching takes it up and to a degree which is frightening, and I've been trying to find where it starts. And what I've found out without really very digging deeply is early maps of Jerusalem, which are meant to explain the pilgrimage route to the pilgrims. And I would be very glad if you could help me.
I think, I mean, it's. I know this convention from 15th century broadsheets. Pilgrimage maps are one, but there are devotional images which use a version of it too. For example, images of the crucified Savior, which have numerically coded references to particular prayers that have to do with one wound or another wound. And it's the same principle, really.
These maps are 13th century.
Now, that's the earliest that I know, and given the need for that kind of map, that could be the source. But these penitential images probably also have manuscript Vorlagen. That is, we know them from work on early printing, but there's no reason to believe that the printers invent them. So as these are more ephemeral than the maps, they may go back too. You know, many systems that we think of as Renaissance or modern are much older. One of the most famous is the BC-AD system, which in any textbook you'll find is invented by the Jesuit Denis Petit in the early 17th century, but is in fact invented by Franciscan world chroniclers several hundred years before. And it's the same kind of notational system, deeply rooted in manuscript conventions rather than in the world of print.
Great. Well, thank you again.